This is FM 100.5 and 101.9. AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
Good afternoon, Rutherford County. We want to let you know that the first part of the show is brought to you by Gold and Coin Connection, and that's at 2568 South Church Street, and that's beside Gateway Tire Center in the Strip Mall. And they have a second location now at 5631 the New Nashville Highway. And Pastor Larry Dunn of ERO Ministries and partners Chris Chico and Wayne Everly buy scrap gold, jewelry, platinum, coins, and silverware. They have vintage sports collectibles and even some great antiques. And for a fair and honest evaluation of your collectibles, take them by and see Pastor Larry Dunn and his partners today at the Gold and Coin Connection, 2568 South Church Street, or 5631 New Nashville Highway, and give them a call at 890-2646. And I have almost a lifelong friend and one of the finest attorneys anywhere in this country, Mr. John Mitchell, who is also, we had Steve Waldron on Friday, and John is also a product of Smyrna, which is amazing that you can get that much ammunition out of one small area like that, Johnny.
Well, I started, and then Steve decided he'd come in and try to show me up.
Well, I can tell you one thing. I wouldn't want to be on either side of that gun, whichever way it's aimed right now. But how was it for you? Because you've got just a little bit of age on Steve, not too much, but you grew up in the late 40s, or in the 40s and the 50s in the Smyrna area.
Yeah, I graduated from Smyrna in 1956.
Wow.
I'm not sure when Steve graduated, but I suspect it was at least 5 or 6 years after that, maybe a little more.
And Smyrna, back when you went, is a little bit different than Steve, because Bud Rakes was not the principal and was not the coach when you were there in Smyrna.
Actually, when I played football, my first coach was Moody Bain. And Bud was my quarterback. Actually, we ran a single wing, so he was our tailback, but he's the one who handed the ball off and threw it and ran very little.
Did Bud ever tip off at all when he was going to throw the ball? Because, you know, there's always something that you look at on defense.
Well, you know, next time you talk to him, Truman, ask him how many times he licked his fingers before he grabbed the ball before a pass.
Now, when you played, I know you played mm-hmm. against some pretty darn good ball players back then.
Yes.
And some pretty good teams. And a lot of them are legends right now.
Well, we played against Huntland, for instance, when the Majors boys were there. I played against Johnny. Mm-hmm. I played against, I think, maybe all of them but Larry. Mm-hmm. And I can remember, oh gosh.
Larry graduated in 59.
Okay, well, maybe I played against him then. But I know Bill and Johnny. Mm-hmm. Of course, Bill got killed.
Right.
And I can remember, let's see, what's the youngest? What was the youngest one's name?
Bobby.
Bobby. Mm-hmm. I can remember Bobby was a kid, and we'd be up there, and he'd be punting the ball up and down the sidelines. Mm-hmm. And as a kid, and he couldn't have been probably over 10 years old, might have been 11 or 12. He could kick it farther than I could, and I was a punter for our team.
Mm.
So that was an athletic family.
It really was, and Shirley was an amazing coach. He has been compared in a lot of ways, even talking to Larry, like our coach Lee Pate. And it was, Larry said it was really pretty tough, you know, when you play with your own dad.
I'll bet it is.
But some of the players that you had on your team, a lot of them had to be products of the air base there at that time. So you had to have some really unbelievable athletes.
Well, we did, but you know, so many of the Air Force children, even though they came to Smyrna, were only there for 1 or 2 years, yeah. And a lot of them didn't play ball. Now we had a boy that played in. His name was Charles Williams. was an excellent end, and was fast as greased lightning. In fact, I was telling you a little story about earlier about Cliburt Hiles, mm-hmm. who was our running back back then, halfback they called him, and he could run 110 flat.
Which is amazing back then.
And that was in pads, and Charles Williams could do that also. But like I told you the story, Cleaver started out, he was wide open, mm-hmm. and by the time he got to the 50-yard line, he had just leveled out. Charles started off slow, and by the time Cleaver got to the 50, Charles was right behind him, and they passed the goal line together. They both mm-hmm. ran 10 flat, but Charles was a slow starter. And Cleaver started out wide open. You can ask Bud when you talk to him. He remembers them both. He played with both of them.
Well, how was it growing up in Smyrna at that time? Because it was a whole lot of difference than the way things are right now.
Well, as you say, it was different there as it is everywhere else. We didn't lock our door the whole time I was growing up. In fact, when my brother was about, 12 or 13, I had inadvertently locked the back door one day. I don't know whether I locked it to keep him out acting ugly or what, but mm-hmm. He came in and broke the lock off the door, and Mother and Daddy never bothered to have it finished or fixed again until after I'd already left home.
Mm. Now, the politics in Smyrna has always been different than a lot of places, as you know, but it's always been like a family atmosphere, whether you were on somebody's political side or not. Outside of Smyrna messed with anybody inside Smyrna.
No, and you didn't have but one political side when I was growing up in Smyrna, and that was the Ridley side. Sam Ridley was the mayor there for, mm-hmm. Lord, I don't know, 30-plus years. And Sam apparently got into some trouble and lost the ability to hold public office, but I know... When I was growing up, if anybody ever needed anything in Smyrna, they checked with Sam, and if it was something they needed to have, he'd see to it that they got it. It wasn't a case of, go away and don't bother me. I'm a politician and you're not. Mm-hmm. He was just one of the people, and he looked after the people there.
That's one thing that's always impressed me about Smyrna, and I've been around it for a long, long time, not as long as you have, but...
You're saying I'm old, right?
No, you and I are not that far apart, big boy. But the thing about it is when you're dealing with government in Smyrna, it's not like you do in normal places back then. It was just like you said a minute ago. It's not like he's the mayor or somebody else is the vice mayor or whatever. You're just talking about doing something that you would, if you're around the table and just talking about Joe or somebody else, there never was any difference. I mean, they were always, it's just like I always thought that government was set up to help the people, not to lord over the people or whatever. And that's the way Smyrna always seemed like me.
That's the way it was. Yeah. I mean, as kids growing up, I knew all the city councilman, and you, Sam, and you, Knox, his twin brother, and you know, I didn't call them Mr. Ridley or Mr. Ridley and so forth and so on. They always came by our house, and my father was on the city council down there for a while. He was police commissioner for several years, but it was always Sam and Knox and some, you know, this, that, and the other. It was like they were your uncles or your cousins or something like that. You didn't look up to them, and I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. You didn't look up to them as idols.
Right.
They were just adults. They were grown folks, and if I needed something, I could ask Sam Ridley. I'd go in. I'd say, Sam, I've got this problem. He'd say, well, what'd your daddy say? I'd say, he said, come see you. And that was about it.
And you're talking about police commissioners. There were very few police officers when you were growing up, as you remember. And most of the time, they were set up on the main drag between Murfreesboro and Nashville.
You mean the so-called speed trap?
Where did that so-called come from?
the folks that lived there said so-called because they were the ones that normally didn't get caught. It was the ones headed from Chicago to Miami.
But you know, Smyrna was just a really, really small town when you and I were growing up, because I used to patrol up through there and got to know just about everybody in Smyrna at one time.
Yeah.
And once that they accepted you there, you were one of them.
That's exactly correct. You know, it was you just home folks, as the old saying goes.
Yeah.
Anybody that lived there, except base personnel, had been there, or their family had been there, basically all everybody's lives. Mm-hmm. You didn't have strangers moving in and staying 2 years and leaving, because you didn't have industry. It was the base. That was the industry, other than like mother, she had her floor shop there, and my wife's mother worked for Earl Coleman.
Mm-hmm.
Earl had the 5 and 10 cent store, and the dry cleaners, and Sam and Knox had the Ridley Chevrolet. Of course, they were all three partners in everything. Mm-hmm. Coleman, Ridley, and Ridley, a lot of the mm-hmm. things were. And Bob Gwynn's father was involved in partnership there at one point in time in the what we always called the Chevrolet place.
Mm-hmm.
But it was fun growing up. We got into stuff, and usually it was taken care of at home. It sort of bend over and grab your ankles, you know, that sort of taken care of.
Remember those days?
I think perhaps we need a little more of that this day and time, but that's not my call.
I agree with you. Now, you've had three major things that I can remember that changed the town of Smyrna drastically. One is that when they came out and turned the lake loose and over in Old Jefferson area and right through there. I mean, that was just a way of life that I never would have thought would have changed.
No, in fact, that took a great portion of my grandfather's farm on my mother's side, Weekly. In mm-hmm. fact, Weekly Hills was what little was left of his farm, and Weekly Road that runs out at the yes. old backside of the base, that was named after him, because that went on out to his mm-hmm. farm until it got wet.
Mm. Do you remember when they were doing that? Do you remember how was the impact? How did it hit the families out there?
Well, you know, at that time, I had gotten married and graduated from MTSU and gone on, so I wasn't actually physically in Smyrna mm-hmm. until, well, let's see, I was gone from 1961 until I came back here in 1966. Mm-hmm. So that was during the period of time when all that transition was taking
right.
place. And I don't remember, you know, too much about how folks were affected by it. But it had already happened when I got back full time.
Yeah, I can remember talking to Coon and talked to Steve some about it. And, you know, there was a movie on years ago, I think it was called Wild River or whatever, when the TVA came in and started blocking up some of it. And it was just amazing to me how people were able to adapt to having their home there. And then the next thing, you know, there's water running where you used to have land. But the other thing was, the other two was when they closed the airbase down. Now, when they closed the airbase down, you and I remember that everybody said that was sounding the death knell of Smyrna. It would never be here again.
It was the end of it. It would roll over and die.
Yeah. And to me, as far as I can remember, Sam really stepped to the head of the plate and said, no, it's going to be better. And it's amazing what Smyrna has done since then.
It really is. And Sam was the originator of it, but obviously he's been out of the picture for years and years, and mm-hmm. it's picked itself up by its own bootstraps and moved on. It's done well.
Yeah. But you think of Smyrna, and you can think about 15 or 20 family names that have been Smyrna all these years.
Exactly.
And you and I have been to, I don't know how many fish fries that Lee Victory put on, and it was just like homecoming, and they would accept us there just like we were born and raised right in Smyrna. And that's always meant a lot to me.
Well, except when I was in high school and there was a little bit of rivalry between the Smyrna Townies and the Murfreesboro Townies over maybe girlfriends or something like that.
You mean those things happened back then?
I'm told they did. Yeah. I personally never was involved in anything like that. I stayed close to home.
But there always was. There was that rivalry between Smyrna and Murfreesboro.
But we were never good enough to play Murfreesboro in football or anything. We were too small.
But I don't remember. Did we have classes in football back then? You know, 1A, 2A, 3A, 4A. I don't remember having classes back then. And why we never did play Smyrna,
I don't know. We played Huntland. We played Greenbrier. We played White House. You know, smaller areas like that. Murfreesboro was a big city as far as we were concerned. And
I remember it being so small.
Yeah, well, well, you know, when I came here in the 66, I think there were 20. I was either the 24th or 25th lawyer in town. Mm-hmm. And now there must be 250 or more. And that's just unbelievable the way it has spurted.
And you're talking about football. When you played Huntland is a very small area.
Yes.
And then how Shirley Majors was ever able to get a team like he did they were just almost unbeatable for 3 or 4 years over there.
Well, he obviously was a great motivator. Mm-hmm. And just like a lot of farm boys, I'll say, they were raw-boned and tough and used to working hard. And he just brought the best of them. You know, back when you and I were not even born, all the people around the counties did was play baseball.
That's right.
And my daddy, I'm told, was an excellent baseball player. His brother was an excellent baseball player. And he, in fact, got an invite to play at MTS, what is now MTSU. Mm-hmm. And I think after his first year, he and the coach had some sort of a disagreement, and he left the football team and took up tennis and won the conference championship.
Wow.
So they were all just great athletes.
That's amazing.
They didn't have television and couches to sit around on. If you were sitting around, you were going waiting on the cows to come in so you could milk them.
That's the good old days right there.
Exactly.
And then you graduated from it was MTSC at that time.
It was, yes.
Middle Tennessee State College. And you didn't really have an idea of going in to aim toward being an attorney at that time,
no,
did you?
None whatsoever. In fact, that would have been the farthest thing from my mind. What little I knew about attorneys was they stand up in front of people and talk, and I could never do that. But as I say, I was married, and we moved to Chattanooga, and I started working for a firm up there that was, I was an insurance adjuster, working on wrecks and paying off people that were injured and that sort of thing, and I had a lot of dealings with attorneys, and I wasn't blowing my own horn, but I kept thinking about a lot of them. Hey, I'm smarter than you are, and you're making a lot of money, and I'm making $400 a month, and so
that wasn't bad money back then.
Well, I wanted $500, and you know, I thought when I got out of college, if I can make $500 a month, I'll be in top cotton. But $400 was the best that I was doing at that time, and I told my wife, I said, what would you think about if I decided to go back to law school? She said, if you'll let me work, she was teaching school at the time, she said, if you'll let me work the rest of this year, and let's pay for I think we'd bought some new living room furniture, pay for that, it'll be okay. And so I did, and she did, and as they say, the rest is history. In fact, my son was born while we were in law school that first year. And now he's my partner, and unfortunately he's approaching 50.
Now that doesn't seem possible.
No.
It doesn't. Because when he first started, he was so young looking.
Yeah.
And he still is, really.
Well, we all were.
Now, did you buy your furniture in downtown Smyrna?
No.
Oh, no. No.
Bought it in Chattanooga because my company up there had... And the same way with my car. They had a deal mm-hmm. where anybody that worked for them could go to this particular furniture company or this particular car dealership, and they cut us a little slack. Mm-hmm. So it was bought up there.
And so you decided.
In fact, I'm not even sure Regal Furniture was in Smyrna at that time.
I think you're right. I don't think it was.
I think that was the old, I'm trying to think what it was, but it wasn't Regal Furniture. That came along afterwards. But like I said, we left in 61.
I wonder where Rusty and Sam were at that time.
Well, I suspect Rusty hadn't been thought of. No, I take that back. When we came back, my wife started back in working for Pusher Howell at Smyrna. And then that was a high school.
Okay.
Actually, before we left, she was teaching school while I was still in college. And she had Rusty in the fourth grade.
Wow.
So he was around, but he wasn't very much around. But he had red hair back then instead of no hair.
Well, we've all changed a little bit.
Tell me about it.
Now, tell me about going to law school. That had to have been a different animal altogether.
It was. I didn't know what to expect, and none of the guys and a few girls that were in school with me knew what to expect, so we just, the first day we were there, the dean stood up in front of us and said, look on either side of you, we're in an auditorium, said, look on either side of you, shake hands and introduce yourself, because in 3 years, one of you won't be here.
Uh-oh.
And he was right. Our loss ratio was probably approaching 50%. Some of them lost interest and left. Others couldn't cut it and left. We had one guy that came down from Chicago. His name was Mark Wheelock. And we were all in our late 20s or mid to late 20s. Couple of them in the early 30s, and Mark was in his 50s, and he was a medical doctor. He was a pathologist and had taught in the pathology department at Northwestern University. And he came down with a wife, two Cadillacs, and bought a house. And the rest of us that were in his study group thought that's the greatest thing in the world. And after the first year, Doc Wheelock, as we called him, began to have some problems. And so we had a study group of about six or eight people that got together and worked together when we had exams coming up and so forth. And we asked him, you know, Doc, what in the world's wrong with you? You're smart. You're a medical doctor. You're a pathologist. You've been head of a department and a university. What's wrong with it? He said, in my profession, he said, it's either black or it's white. 1 + 1 = 2.
Mm-hmm.
He said, in this profession, there is no black area, there's no white area, it's a great gray area, and 1 + 1 doesn't always equal to 2. He could not understand that if you had a problem you were presented with, that it had two sides. He could only see one side. Now, mm-hmm. he could see one side well, but he couldn't rationalize the fact that there was another side.
And don't you think that
sort of like Guy Dawson being a district attorney and then coming out and going into private practice with his son?
Guy Dawson came up with the judge handed me a note when Guy was breaking apart one of the psychiatrists. He was the expert witness on one of the cases.
Mm-hmm.
And Guy kept probing him on why he thought that his opinion was correct. And finally, Guy asked him the one question that probably no psychiatrist wants to be asked. He said, so what you're telling me, in your opinion, is a mathematical certainty. And the guy could not answer that. And see, that's the hard thing for most people to understand about law, is that you may, in your own mind, feel like that you have a great case, or maybe you feel like you have a poor case. But a lot of it is how it's presented to the people, to the judge, and to the individuals. And a lot of times, your case lays in the hands of your attorney.
Well, that's true. And you always hear about this slick attorney that, you know, got the jury to buy his side of it. Actually, that's not the way it works. It's the attorney who is the best prepared and presents a more logical solution to a jury that usually comes out, not always, but usually comes out on top. Get a guy in here sometime and get him to tell you how he got his job here when he first left and came headed north. He left, he and I were in school together, and he left the Huntland area. Elora is a little closer to his neck of the woods, but anyway, and he was headed to Nashville to see about getting a job with the state, so I'm told. And he called me when he was going through, because as I say, we were classmates. And we got to talking, and he told me where he was going. I said, well, I know a fellow that's looking to hire somebody, if you'd be interested in talking to him. It was Bill Wright, and Bill's been dead for years now, but he said, well, he said, where is he? And I said, well, his office is just around the corner from where I am, and I told him. And he went over and talked to Mr. Wright, and it turned out he decided not to go on to Nashville and see about working for the state. He ended up working for the state anyway when he became district attorney. But he practiced law here. He and I were the two newest attorneys in town.
And he became DA, and if I remember, Wiley Holloway became the judge.
That's correct.
And Wiley Holloway was the DA.
Yes. When I started, Wiley was the district attorney. And Dick LaRoche was, well, he started out as judge pro tem. He was a circuit judge.
And the rest is history.
As they say, the rest is history. Exactly.
And we want to let you know that this portion of the show is brought to you by Pirtle and Howerton Automotive. That's Mark Pirtle and John Howerton. And their business is at 2006 North Main Street in Shebaville, Tennessee. And if you're looking for a Ford, Mercury, Chevrolet, Buick, or GMC, give them a call, 1-800-264-6800, or pull them up on the internet, PirtleHowerton.com, and then take about a 20-25 minute drive from Murfreesboro to Shebaville. It's on your left before you get into downtown. Go in, see the nice people, and have yourself a great day, and come back with a brand new car.
Hello, my name is Lance Jenkins, candidate for property assessor. As your next property assessor, I will ensure that every property owner is treated fair and equally. I have over 17 years experience in the property assessor's office, serving from 1987 to 2004 as deputy assessor under former assessor Tommy Sanford. I would appreciate your vote for property assessor. Early voting, February 15th through February 28th. I am Lance Jenkins, and I approve this message, Lynn E. Jenkins Treasurer. Vote Lance Jenkins, property assessor.
Hello, this is Truman Jones. We have a new sponsor, and one that you're going to be delighted with. It's National Healthcare, National Healthcare Corporation, right here in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. And this is where life is celebrated. Discover a different kind of care, one that ensures that you're surrounded by people who make a difference in your life. In 11 states, patients and residents feel right at home at National Healthcare Corporation's more than 130 affiliated healthcare centers and home care offices. Their family of facilities delivers exceptional rehabilitative skilled nursing and extended care in locations that are close to home and family. In line with their longtime commitment to provide a continuum of care to those who need their services at any age. And want to let you know that this is a local business started here, even though it's pretty much all through the Southeast. National Healthcare, Murfreesboro, where life is celebrated.
This is Good Neighbor Events, brought to you by the Rutherford Home Show, Saturday mornings at 11:30 on WGNS, the Omni Hut Restaurant in Smyrna, and AmeriCare Pest Control.
Hello, I'm Dave Gober with First Community Mortgage.
And Dean Higby with South Branch Nursery.
Be sure to tune in every Saturday from 11:30 to 12:30 for the Rutherford Home Show, presented by Old South Properties.
We are joined each week by local professionals to give helpful information about your home and the local community.
We also give you local real estate stats and rate information.
Join us here on WGNS for the Rutherford Home Show every Saturday, 11:30 to 12:30.
Now, Good Neighbor Events from WGNS. The AARP is offering a free tax aid program to persons age 60 plus whose total family income is $50,000 per year or less. This is over at the St. Clair Street Senior Center, and appointments are necessary. Phone 848-2550 for information. A similar service for all ages over at the Greenhouse Ministries. That, too, requires a total household income of $50,000 or less. Now, here's a date to put on your calendar, March the 17th. That's a Saturday night. And the Fun Backstage Bash on the street right in front of the Center for the Arts in Uptown Murfreesboro. Great food and, let me tell you, phenomenal music, the big band sound of Music City Swing. For information about this annual Center for the Arts fundraiser, call them at 904-ARTS. A special Lawn and Garden 101. That's going to be March the 2nd and 3rd, Friday and Saturday. There is a $10 fee, and that includes lunch on Saturday, as well as all the materials. Phone 898-7710 for information. And those are Good Neighbor Events.
You're listening to The Truman Show on WGNS, AM and FM. Now back to Truman Jones.
And this portion of the show is brought to you by Stan McNabb Automotive. And they provide quality vehicles from Chevrolet, Dodge, Jeep, Ford, and Cadillac to the Murfreesboro, McMinnville, and Shelbyville, Tennessee area. Their large selection ensures that they have a vehicle for everyone, no matter what it is you're looking for. And for a quality used car in Tullahoma, visit their dealership located at 2000 North Jackson Street. They have a large inventory of pre-owned cars, trucks, SUVs, and minivans to select from. At Stan McNabb Automotive, they pride themselves in the quality that they offer on all of their used cars, which makes them a major destination for used vehicles. And only at Stan McNabb can you get free oil changes and free tires for the life of that vehicle. You know, I have had the pleasure of witnessing some of the more monumental trial cases ever in the history of Rutherford County.
I'm sure you have.
And I have watched you and the general, and I, of course, I always mention Guy Dotson as the general.
Yes.
That must have been some interesting happenings in the classroom for you, in the courtroom, not the classroom. Sometimes I felt like it was a classroom.
Well,
for me, it was.
In a sense, it is a classroom.
Yeah.
And that we're trying to teach our respective theories to someone who has absolutely no idea what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we've had some good battles. He beat me once, and I'd beat him twice, and he beat me twice, and I'd beat him once. And that's not a correct assessment of it. Beating, I would be successful on one, and then he'd be successful on the other. The good part about his side was that if he lost, nobody went to jail.
Yeah.
If I lost, quite often my client went to jail, or at least he may have gotten probation, but he may have been guilty.
Can you read your client when, say, if he's been charged with a major crime, and that's mostly when you would represent somebody, can you read the man? Can you get a feel of him on how he's going to be in court?
Yes. To answer that question, generally, yes, but it takes a while. You won't do it the first few trials because you have a tendency or at least I did, I had a tendency to try to believe every story that a client told me, until after a while I began to realize, wait a minute, I don't know that I can buy this. And it got to the point where if somebody would come in and say, this is the way it happened, I'd say, listen, I don't believe you. What makes you think a jury will believe you? Mm-hmm. Now tell me what happened and I'll see if you've got a defense. Mm-hmm. If you didn't have a defense, then you tried to work out as good a solution for your client as you could. If you did have a defense and you could convince the district attorney's office that you had a good defense, they would either, number one, make you a better offer than they had before, or number two, you'd end up going to trial. Now, Truman, you know as well as I do that only a small percentage of people that are arrested ever actually go to a jury trial.
Don't have the time for
No. If you had to do that, you'd be backed up for 5 to 10 years. Mm-hmm. And you'd need at least three times the number of judges that you have now.
There's absolutely no doubt in my mind that almost all, and let's just call it deals that are made between the district attorney, the defense attorneys, and the judicial, the judge, are almost always fair for each side. And you think of all the manpower hours that are spent by a great number of people just in a courtroom. You're right. It would be impossible to even come close to trying all of them.
You couldn't do it. And we were fortunate when Guy was a district attorney. When I say we, I'm talking about the defense bar.
Right.
Now, I did other things than criminal cases, but that was, the bulk of my practice. But Guy was one of these people that he could look at it and see, this guy needs to go and never come back, or, he messed up. Mm-hmm. But he comes from pretty good folks, and maybe if we cut him some slack, he won't mess up again. And in those type of situations, he would give you an agreement that you could, in most instances, convince your client to agree to. Mm-hmm. Because you don't ever say, hey, this is a deal you're going to take. This is a deal you should consider strongly, because right. If you don't, it could be a whole lot worse. And I've had some that say, hey, roll the dice. Sometimes we won, quite often we lost.
Do you feel sometimes you see a weakness in the state's case?
Absolutely.
All right, every time. But now let's say a capital crime. And you feel like some way that a couple of the witnesses are going to be not very strong for the state. Is that a time that you start visiting the DA's office and say, now, listen, I know you guys got a problem. Is there some way that we're going to be able to lessen the impact?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And they will always have a couple of those witnesses, because the state has to depend to a large degree, in some cases, upon characters whose reputation is not too savory. Mm-hmm. And so they have to go in saying, look, we've got these two guys that are going to testify as to what happened, and they found out in jail with this, what was going on, and they're not the salt of the earth, but we believe them and we want you to. And the only thing you can do in a situation like that, if they won't, as we like to say, roll over just a little bit, mm-hmm. is to try to discredit that witness. But yeah, those are the kind you go to. No, if they've got you dead to rights, you just go in and say, hey, we did it and we're sorry, but we're good folks and maybe it won't happen again. Now, I've had several murder cases where it's sort of like the old saying used to be in Cannon County, if he needed killing and you were the right one to do the job, you're not guilty. I've had several murder cases where the guy needed to get killed, mm-hmm. and I was successful in most of them. And I'm never, and I say this knocking on wood because I'm not trying cases anymore, but I never lost a case in Cannon County, either civil or criminal. I don't know whether I was just lucky or whether my clients were just lucky. Now, I've lost a lot here, but in Cannon County, I never lost a case. Of course, you didn't have that many cases up there.
Yeah. But everybody knows everybody in Cannon County. And they know the history of each family.
That's the theory. Did he need killing? Mm-hmm. I guess the best one we had up there was when Jack had just gotten out of law school, and I got permission to him sit second chair. And it was the one where the old barber was killed. You remember the case?
Mm-hmm, I do.
In fact,
we had him in jail here.
The two guys that I represented were brothers from Indiana, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know whether to believe them or not. Mm-hmm. And they both swore and would to this day that they didn't have anything to do with it. And of course, the guy that turned state's evidence supposedly brought his father in as one of the murderers, one of the mm-hmm. killers. The state cut him some slack because he may have been a juvenile at the time it occurred.
He was young, yeah.
And he made a terrible witness, but he was all they had. Mm-hmm. And as it turned out, and to this day, I don't know whether my clients were guilty or not. They were acquitted, as was this kid's father. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the few that I've ever gone into where I was absolutely distraught because I didn't know whether I was representing an innocent man or a guilty man. I didn't have any problem representing somebody that was guilty because there are degrees of guilt. Mm-hmm. But to represent somebody that you actually think is innocent is about as stressful as anything you can do as a defense attorney.
Is voir dire really that useful to you as a defense attorney when you're questioning prospective jurors?
It would be, were it not for the fact that for the last many years we've had jury questionnaires mm-hmm. that they have to fill out, given a little background and so forth and so on. And you have to do your homework. You've got to take those questionnaires, put them against the jury panel that's going to be pulled, and then if you can find somebody either in your office or somebody that around town that you know that might know one or two of these individuals, just sort of get a feel of what kind of, you know, are they pretty narrow-minded, are they fairly liberal, are they just a straight shooter. Mm-hmm. You have to do your homework. If you don't check up on your jury, then you're going to lose 7 out of 10 times.
I'm sure you can't always read them. Have you ever had a juror that absolutely just blew your mind?
Yes. We had a murder case here many years ago. My friend Stanley Rogers represented the young man. He was from Manchester, and he called me in to assist him with the case, and it was first degree murder as a kid, and I know you remember this one, a kid out here at the university that killed his roommate. Mm-hmm. After the questionnaires, we went through everything and then we tried the case and so forth. They found the boy guilty, which no question but what he was guilty, and so we were trying to get the jury to, because he was a kid, he was 18, 19 years old, see if they would give him life with the possibility of parole. And they came back and cut us off at the knees, gave him life without parole. And then I was talking to one of the jurors after. In fact, he approached me outside after all was said and done. He said, you know we had a problem? I said, no, I don't know you had a problem. I know we had a problem. We ended up with a problem. What was your problem? He said, well, when we went in there to discuss life with or without parole, said there were 10 of us that were willing to give him parole.
Wow.
And he said, you remember juror number so-and-so and juror number so-and-so? There were two ladies.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah, I know the ones you're talking about. We had thought they were, you know, pretty good jurors in our investigation of the jury and so forth and so on. He said they absolutely were not going to move.
Hmm.
In fact, if they could have given him the death penalty, they would, but that wasn't on the table. But he said the 10 of us wanted to give him parole, and they were not going to move at all. And so we had totally misread them because we thought they were good jurors. And they didn't have a problem with the guilt or innocent phase because he was guilty. There, right. There wasn't any question about that. So it was just a case of, you know, can you give him a break because he's a kid? And those two ladies were absolutely not going to cut him any slack at all. And the guy that approached me, he said, let me tell you. And I said, okay. And he did. He was amazed. And he said, my other 9 jurors that were with me, he said, we just sat there and shook our head because we knew we were going to be there for a long time. So they the 10 came around to seeing it the way of the 2. And that happens infrequently, but it does happen. Jurors are sort of like the weather.
Doesn't that bother you, though?
Yeah, but what else are you going to do?
Yeah, I know. But you think about it, these 10 people hold the decision of that individual's life or for the state, either way. And is it because of... that they're just tired of fighting, but you've got somebody there that you've got 10 that believe solid that the person deserves to have parole, and then you have the 2 that have got their backs up and say no.
Well,
for
course,
whatever it may have been, some past history with.
Of course,
them.
What they yeah, it, what the 10 didn't realize that was that if they had held out and they hung up on the punishment, it would have been with the possibility of parole,
mm-hmm.
but they didn't know that and they rolled because. They didn't want to argue with them, or for whatever reason. And it doesn't matter. I mean, that's what juries do. Sometimes one will hold up 11, and that's happened frequently. And sometimes with good results. But usually it's because there's one individual or two individuals that have a... their perception is totally different than what the rest of the panel. And then of course you also have sometimes 5 or 6 on there that they'll go whichever way the wind blows.
You know, there's a lot of passion in the courtroom on some of these cases, especially the capital cases and things like that. And I have watched you guys battle it out all the way through to the very end. And then after it's over with, and then all the emotions are gone. And I'm talking about you guys of days gone by when I used to watch it.
Right.
You always had a great respect for each other, whether it's the prosecution or the defense. And you were able to go along with your lives and still maintain that respect and friendship. And that's something I've always been able to admire because, I mean, you guys are playing for the highest stakes possible. And how in the world have you... been able to maintain that all this time.
You know,
I know what respect you have for Guy Dodson.
Yeah. You know, we get that question all the time. How can you go shake his hand, or how can you see him the next day and say hi to him? Because he's doing a job. Mm-hmm. I was doing a job. It's not anything personal between adversaries. We are just that. We're adversaries. Mm-hmm. It'd be the same thing as if we were playing baseball. And I was pitching, and Guy was the batter. And he hit a home run off me that won the game. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go slug him. I'm going to say good hit.
Well, in our days, you wouldn't
yeah.
anyway.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
And we want to let you know that this portion of the show is brought to you by At Home Care. And that's Melissa Warren's business, and she started some time ago just to make sure that you can stay in your home and have all the duties taken care of, all the errands run, and you can stay there without the normal pains of trying to keep up and where you're no longer able to do that. And if that sounds like something you need, give her a call at 713-4639. pull her up on the internet, www.athomecaretennessee.com, and just live your life the way it's meant to be and just enjoy it.
Be a hero for kids with cancer. Join Bald in the Borough's second annual St. Baldrick's event on March 16th at 4 p.m. located in Lanes, Trains, and Automobiles in Murfreesboro. You can be a part of the excitement, whether you shave your head, volunteer, or donate. You'll be given hope to those kids fighting childhood cancers. Go to baldintheborough.com and see how you can be a hero too. Sponsored by Murfreesboro Medical Clinic.
My name is Joe Frank Jernigan. I am running for road superintendent of Rutherford County in the Republican primary. I am a lifelong resident of Rutherford County and am the current assistant road superintendent and have held this job for over 10 years. Early voting starts February 15th through February 29th and election day is March 6, 2012. I would appreciate your vote, paid for by friends of Joe Frank Jernigan.
It's the Truman Show, a look at the people and news shaping Rutherford County with Truman Jones.
And welcome back with Johnny Mitchell. Johnny, you had such an interesting life and you've done so many great things. Have you? Are there anything that really stands out in your mind as special being in the courtroom all these years? I know you've been in court with some great judges and the DA and all the players. Was there one particular case that stands out in your mind more than any? I know that's a hard thing to do with all the hundreds you've had.
Yeah, as I say, it was the murder of the barber in Woodbury and the, as we call it, the Spot Drake case,
right
here in Murfreesboro. There was also a couple of other cases here in Murfreesboro that, you know, the ones that stand out in your mind best are the ones you win. And I've lost a few that I felt like we had a decent defense, not a great defense, or we wouldn't have been going to trial.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go to trial on one where you've got a great defense, because the state will make you an offer, as they say, you can't refuse.
Do you think that a lot of times law enforcement, when an officer testifies in court, do they give an officer, the jurors, do they give him or her a little bit more attention than they say some of the other witnesses, because they are professionals and they are out there to represent them?
In my judgment, they do. Not in all cases.
Mm-hmm.
But if the officer comes across strong and comes across as telling it like it is, mm-hmm. Yeah, they will give him more than they would the man on the street saying the same thing. Because, as you say, he's here to serve and protect and to mm-hmm. tell the truth. As we all know, that's not always correct. And we've had some of that in recent years. But, yeah, I think they tend to. And the question is, when you ask a jury, would you give Officer A more credibility than you would Joe over here on the side of the street?
Mm-hmm.
And they all say no, but then you know good and well they're going to. That's when you have to try to know your jury and have done your research and have a good idea who you want on the panel and who you don't.
That's a hard thing for a juror to answer those questions truthfully, when a lot of times the juror really doesn't know.
Well,
you know, everybody has hidden feelings.
That's true. We all do, but when you say you won't, and then you go back in the jury room and you say, well, I believe the officer, but I don't know about this other guy over here, then you haven't done, you know, you could say, I don't believe either one of them, or I believe both of them, and we got to try to correct that difference in our own minds. What do you other 11 people think? That sort of thing.
You know, we all read jurors when they're sitting there listening. And you mentioned one a minute ago, a couple of them that fooled you.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always found it interesting to listen to some of the words that come out of the jurors' mouths after they leave. And a lot of time, the perception is not what you're seeing. I mean, they can totally throw you off when they're sitting up there.
Absolutely. And some of them do it on purpose. There was, you remember the McGill murders?
Oh, very well.
Well, I had a friend that was on the jury, and Guy will tell you this too, but this was a juror that told me. There was a particular individual that agreed that he would consider the death penalty. Mm-hmm. And when they got back in the jury room, he said, "We'll stay here, as it were, till hell freezes over, because I will not agree to the death penalty on that defendant or those defendants."
They were all young.
All young. But he had told Guy in his examination that he would consider the death penalty if he were selected as a juror. And this friend of mine who was on the jury, he was an old Smyrna friend, mm-hmm. told me that when they got in there, that's the first thing he said when the door was closed.
That was one of the saddest cases I have ever seen, saddest trials, and it's the only one I ever remember where the prosecution and the defense, the families all sat together because they were interrelated, and actually I was related to two sides.
Really?
Over there. Yeah, so it still stands out in my mind as one of the saddest of all.
Yeah.
Been a great show. I always enjoy being with you. I have a great deal of respect for you, and I'm glad that Jack is carrying on for the family.
Well, we hope so.
And I'd love to have you back on again.
Truman, I appreciate it.
Maybe we can have you and Guy on one day.
That'd be good.
I don't want to get caught in the middle, though.
Yeah, well, you just stand back and turn us loose.
Yeah, I will.
Okay.
Thanks, Johnny.
Appreciate it.
And we'll see you guys tomorrow at 2 o'clock.